This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this broadcast is provided by the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to AMDA On The Go. This podcast will focus on a specific disparity in elder care. Nearly 20 years ago, in the Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA report, Cultural Competency, A Journey, then Administrator Dr. Claude Earl Fox commented, "Healthcare providers are beginning to recognize that addressing the cultural uniqueness of their patients is essential to positive health outcomes." But how far have we truly come in our recognition, understanding, and approach to culturally diverse populations in healthcare? With regard specifically to the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender populations, commonly referred to by the acronym LGBT, a 2015 American Geriatric Society Ethics Committee position statement on the care of the older LGBT patient pointedly reflected on the significant disparity, beginning with the first sentence. "There is ample evidence that LGBT individuals face discrimination in the healthcare setting." In fact, it wasn't until 2013 that the National Health Interview Survey via the Centers for Disease Control National Health Statistics report included a measure of sexual orientation to look at key health indicators. And in a 2012 white paper, AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine, also weighed in support of the aging LGBT population, beginning with the recognition that this population was a historically disadvantaged sector of society. The white paper summary clearly articulated where healthcare needed to be and read, "While neither policy statement nor practice recommendations can quickly and easily affect pervasive, individual, institutional, or organizational culture change, advocacy for all elders, regardless of sexual orientation, gender identity, or other human attributes, supports the best interest and optimal practice of all long-term care stakeholders." Who continues to advocate now for this unique segment of the adult population? According to its website, since 1978, SAGE, the oldest and largest organization in advocacy of the aging LGBT population, has ensured that LGBT elders receive just and fair access to opportunities such as healthcare. SAGE represents itself as the go-to organization on a national scale. And to help us navigate through the cultural awareness that we seek on LGBT issues and aging, we are delighted to have with us now the Director of National Projects for SAGE, Dr. Tim Johnston. Dr. Johnston was awarded his doctorate in philosophy with a focus on women's and gender studies from the State University of New York at Stony Brook. He has served on the LGBT Aging Issues Network. He has been an advisory council member for the Center of Excellence in Assisted Living, SEAL, and has been a board member for the National Consumer Voice for Quality Long-Term Care. We are awaiting his latest textbook for providers on creating LGBT-inclusive senior living communities. Dr. Johnston, welcome to AMDA On The Go.
Thank you very much for having me. Delighted to be here.
Dr. Johnston, it seems a sad commentary that nearly 20 years since the HRSA report on cultural competency, the inability to recognize that the LGBT population is made up of individuals deserving of uniquely focused plans of care is ongoing. In fact, a 2011 report by the then Institute of Medicine identified a number of barriers to care within the LGBT population, including a lack of providers knowledgeable about specific health needs, fear of discrimination in the healthcare setting, and the issues around the fact that LGBT elders were more likely to rely on friends and not family as caregivers. Give us a historical perspective, perhaps starting around the year 2000 or before, on where we have been and where we are now with regard to the appreciation of the healthcare-specific needs of the LGBT population. Why do we still have this aspect of discrimination prevalent in healthcare? Where do we need to be, and how do we get there?
That's an excellent question, and I think I am going to go back a little further than the year 2000. When I do this work and I talk about the needs of LGBT older adults, often the first thing people say to me is, oh my goodness, I never thought about LGBT people getting older. And what that tells me is that oftentimes people aren't considering the intersection of age and LGBT identity. And when we think about the experience that a lot of LGBT elders have gone through, they have learned that their survival depends upon staying hidden. So whether it be government administrations that would seek out LGBT employees to fire them, whether it be the stigma associated with the diagnosable psychological disorder of homosexuality. It could be the fact that transgender folks are still diagnosed with something called gender dysphoria. Those things combined then, especially with the legacy of the HIV/AIDS crisis, have created a lot of fear in the LGBT community about interacting with healthcare providers and other large institutions. So one of the big problems that we see is that folks don't even access services. They're often very underutilized because they're afraid of experiencing discrimination. And it could be the case that that provider is actually quite welcoming, but because of the history of their experience, they approach them with a feeling of unease or distrust. So I think having that historical perspective is really important to understand that oftentimes making an LGBT person feel comfortable, especially an LGBT older adult, really requires going the extra mile. Later, I'm sure we'll talk about specific best practices like training or ways to change your outreach to be reaching the LGBT population. But I think really looking at it from that broad historical perspective can help build a lot of empathy for LGBT people.
You know, you raised something that brought back a memory for me. When I was a third year medical student at Boston City Hospital, I would say at least 20% of admissions were due to HIV related issues. And I don't know, maybe it's just my naivete, but I would have thought all the emphasis on treating that disease and working with populations at risk to try to improve care, you would have thought that, you know, 25 years later would have taken hold in some sort of trusting type of environment. But I guess that's still not the case.
A couple interesting things to note. One thing is that due to the advances in antiretroviral therapy, we're really seeing one of the first generations of older people living with HIV and AIDS. So I think the statistic is as of the year 2015, 50% of people living with HIV or AIDS are over the age of 50.
Wow.
So it means that a lot of providers who aren't accustomed to working with people living with HIV or AIDS are now working with them for the first time in their careers. But another thing that I'll note is that for a long time, anti-LGBT sentiment has operated on what I think of as a contagion model, where being LGBT was seen as something that you could catch, or that the presence of an LGBT person could somehow turn other people LGBT or ruin a space. We obviously know that that's not the case, but that contagion logic has been at play in pushback against the LGBT community for a long time. And then with the HIV/AIDS crisis, where predominantly gay men initially in the United States were being infected with a deadly virus, it only served to increase and kind of link that stigma to the contagion model.
Dr. Johnson, tell us a little bit more about SAGE as a resource for programming and positive outcomes for the older LGBT population. You know, where does policy fit into the discussion? Where can physicians and advanced practitioners play a role, especially with the knowledge that LGBT older adults are at greater risk of physical and mental health disorders, are less likely to have received regular health benefits, have higher rates of alcohol and tobacco use, and may have limited health literacy?
So SAGE is headquartered in New York City, and in the New York City area, we run several innovative senior centers and do a lot of direct work with our constituents. We also have a network of affiliates all over the country who do direct programming and can serve as information hubs or way to connect with local community members. But I would say, in terms of the other work that we do, we run a lot of training. So we've trained over 40,000 providers all across the country on LGBT cultural competency. And we do also do some amount of policy work. And to answer your question about policy, there are a couple of things I can point to. One is that we are always trying to make it such that LGBT older adults and older adults living with HIV or AIDS are designated as a population of greatest social need. Mm. Some states, such as California, have enacted LGBT long-term care residence rights or Bill of Rights, which those are very important advocacy tools for us. And I would say from my perspective, leading up our training work, anything we can do to mandate or encourage cultural competency training is going to have a huge impact. Because if I'm invited by a bunch of providers to come in and give a presentation, that says to me that they're open to working with the community and want to learn more. I'm actually very interested in training the people who would not show up to one of my sessions, who might hold harsher beliefs about the LGBT community that I and my team of trainers can help them work through to understand their role in providing culturally competent care to LGBT seniors.
How do you get beyond that barrier?
I think it's important to recognize that people who work in the care industry care. You know, they're often in this line of work because that's where their base orientation is toward helping other people. So a lot of times it's about depressurizing the situation and saying, I'm not here to change your mind. I'm not here to change your religious beliefs or your deeply held convictions. What I'm here to do is give you the skill set that you need to provide person-directed care to everybody that you're working with. And that often can help. A lot of times it's important for people to hear the stories of LGBT elders. They might have misconceptions about what LGBT people are like, how they act, their beliefs, etc. And really meeting people who are LGBT can go a long way to creating empathy.
What's the nature of the competency that you teach? What's the essence?
I think the essence of our training is to help people spend a little bit of time walking in the shoes and understanding the experiences of an LGBT older person. Mm. It's about taking that desire that they have to help and letting them understand what their role is in providing care. I would say the number one thing that I hear when people are resisting coming to a training is, I don't really think I need this training because I treat everyone the same. And when working with this population, treating them like you do everybody else is not going to get through to them. The status quo is not necessarily welcoming. So I try to get people to see that going that extra mile can make a huge difference in the lives of our constituents.
I have to tell you, that comment reminds me of when I decided that I wanted to be a geriatrician. And I think many of my geriatric colleagues would agree. And I went to my mentor and I said, I want to be a geriatrician. And he said, why do you want to be a geriatrician? We work with old people every day. If there's anything geriatricians recognize is that there is an understanding and a lack of understanding when it comes to elder care, even for those people who believe that they work with elders every day. So I definitely appreciate that philosophy.
Our interview will continue after this brief message from the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support the future of PALTC by remembering the foundation in your will or trust. Email Christine Ewing at CEWING@PALTCFoundation.org for more information. Thank you.
We're talking with Dr. Tim Johnston on the disparity of healthcare in the LGBT population. Dr. Johnston, in its white paper, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine urged the provision of ethical, responsible, and equitable treatment and quality care to LGBT and all other individuals in long-term care. You, however, have written about or commented on the darker side of LGBT issues, including bullying, prevention of partners or significant others and having surrogacy roles, and the lack of LGBT issues specific training in aging service providers, as you've just discussed. The SAGE website comments that in one state, 45% of same-sex couples who applied for senior housing were discriminated against. Given your role with SEAL, even knowing that assisted living facilities are currently mostly hospitality or social models of care, which I think weighs in here, but important nonetheless in post-acute care itself in the realm, how do we even begin in these settings, as well as in the skilled nursing setting, with nursing, case management, social work, and therapy services to accomplish the goals that the society recommended 6 years ago?
Well, I think the first step is to recognize that LGBT older adults exist. As I noted before, sometimes people don't even really think about that intersection. And to understand that if you are a provider working in one of these community settings and you've never known that you had an LGBT resident, chances are you have. They just didn't feel comfortable opening up about their identity and their history. So the kinds of recommendations that we give, you know, the bedrock for everything is training. You have to give your staff the skills that they need to work with LGBT people. And that training discusses things like terminology, what words are considered affirming and respectful, what words should be avoided. We talk about the history of the LGBT experience, get a little bit into the distinction between sex, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, things like that. But also a lot of skills, such as reflecting people's language back to them and not making assumptions about how people identify, or recognizing non-traditional care structures, families of choice or friends who should be brought into a care plan but might not be seen by somebody who's kind of stuck in the nuclear family model. Other things that can really help are robust statements about a commitment to equity and being a welcoming environment, and statements that explicitly mention the LGBT community so that folks can see that statement of intent and see themselves reflected in it. We encourage people to think about programming that you do that can be made more LGBT inclusive, outreach materials. Part of the Sage Care training program that I run, once you've been credentialed by us, we give you a bunch of materials that can be used on brochures or placed within a community setting that have visual signals like rainbow colors, that this is a place where LGBT people live and work and are welcome. And kind of the last thing that I'll say is that we still don't have a lot of data about these folks, because a lot of long-term care, acute care, even certain medical settings don't collect robust data on people's sexual orientation or gender identity. So again, these questions should be treated delicately like other demographic information. They should be optional. You can't force someone to talk about this part of their identity. But we do need to create more mechanisms where that information is being collected so that we have a better feel for the experiences of our constituents across the care community.
There clearly is much work to be done. And as you're speaking, I'm thinking about how, although I don't want to equate the two in any way, it just, an analogy is the training that we receive in the post-acute long-term care setting that is often mandated in some states in dementia care. You know, just for the concept of all inclusivity, as you comment, it would be great if we also had additional training, not necessarily as a mandate, but just in helping to understand all of our populations. So it would seem to me that training in LGBT issues and specific needs would be important. Are you seeing this philosophy grow across the nation? Is there more acceptance despite what we've talked about in the assisted living world, post-acute care world?
I think your comparison to training on working with folks living with dementia is really accurate. And I'll give you just two examples that show how it is often very similar. I remember when I first learned that when working with someone living with dementia, you should always approach them from the front and ideally at eye level so that you don't inadvertently startle them. And that was such an easy and simple thing that I would never have known if I hadn't received that specific training, but radically reconfigured how I interacted with folks who I know have dementia. A similar thing that we train people on in our work is when you're first getting to know someone, if you ask a question like, are you married? That might send or communicate the assumption that you think that person is heterosexual, because for a lot of folks, marriage is still seen as a rather heterosexual institution. So I train folks to just say, tell me about the important people in your life. And what that does is it really helps you as the provider to get a feel for what is this person's network? Who are the other folks that need to be included in their care planning or could be invited to the next meeting with a doctor, for example. So I think your comparison is right on, where a lot of times people just need the kind of basic skills to work with a population that they might not otherwise be familiar with.
Right. And, you know, of interest, I recently received a survey from the American Association of Hospice and Palliative Care Medicine regarding LGBT issues and asking for information on how much knowledge our institutions or our unique worlds in general foster with regard to this population. And I was remiss to say that I could not answer that I strongly agreed with my institution or institutions representing this population well or training around this population. So this is definitely an issue, but I wanted you to know that other societies are asking these questions and looking into this issue as well.
Yeah, and to answer the second part of your previous question around the interest in training, I've been overseeing our training work for 5 years now, and in the last year have seen a tremendous growth in interest on this topic. So we are training people as fast as we can, and we're getting more and more requests every day, but it's still a very small drop in a very large pond. And one thing that I really want to emphasize is that sometimes people think of this training as being maybe politically contentious or difficult in a way because people often have complicated feelings about the LGBT community. I would encourage people to get excited about this training because I think it's really cutting edge. I think it is a new topic for a lot of people working in the field, and having your staff trained to really provide excellent care to LGBT people can only benefit other patients as well. So I think it should really be thought of as something innovative and a kind of cool challenge to be met, and not as a, you know, just another mandated training that everybody has to sit through.
Dr. Johnston, as has become customary in the time that we have remaining, I wish to be a little provocative with you regarding forecasting. I find myself continuously concerned about the elder population for whom I or my fellow geriatricians do not provide care. And at the end of the day, I want to trust that all of my colleagues are going to continue to invest in the needs of elders across all the borders of diversity. Will there come a time in which we can feel at ease and confident knowing that the LGBT segment of the elder population has not received disparate care? Will there be a time in which advocacy from organizations such as SAGE or the National Center for Transgender Equality, Lambda Legal, or the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force are no longer needed? I fear that I won't see change in my time as a physician, but what can my future fellow, as I like to call them, Joe Amdas in the trenches of post-acute and long-term care expect?
It is a provocative question because you're asking me when I will have worked myself out of a job. So, you know, I can't say when I think that will happen. I can say that SAGE envisions an equitable world in which LGBT older adults thrive because they're valued and have boundless opportunities. That's our kind of guiding vision. And I think when we achieve success in the direction that you're talking about, I think what that success will look like is that people of all ages who are LGBT will feel comfortable self-disclosing. It won't be a big deal. It won't be something that causes anxiety for them. And then that they will receive equitable, competent, and fair care. You know, that's what it's going to look like when we've achieved these goals. And your question makes me think of two things and two ways to approach this. One is at the structural level. You know, we need stronger protections in place for the LGBT community. We need more training. We need a recognition from the state and federal level that these are folks with unique needs that have to be addressed. But I think even once we make all those structural changes, there's still going to be a role for advocates to make sure it's happening, to be providing the training to allow people to execute on that competent care, to be looking out for members of our community who are more vulnerable and need a helping hand. So we're definitely working toward that world, but I think it is work that for many reasons will be ongoing.
We have been fortunate to speak with and learn from Dr. Jim Johnston, National Projects Director for SAGE. Dr. Johnston, thank you so much for spending your time with AMDA On The Go.
Thank you very much for having me.
References for this podcast and information about SAGE can be found at paltc.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this innovation podcast that we call AMDA On The Go.
Support for this broadcast is provided by the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM, pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast title. Thank you.